for your chance to win.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll have an in-depth discussion on child marriage and how girls are valued around the world. Married teenage girls are often physically abused and forced into lives of chores and childbearing. The Worth of a Girl on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello there. Today is Thursday, August the 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump visits two cities rocked by mass shootings, but still had words for his critics.
My critics are political people. They're trying to make points. In many cases, they're running for president, and they're very low in the polls. A couple of them in particular, very low in the polls.
Shooting attacks, renewed debate over domestic terrorism in the U.S. Also ahead, American musicians are using their voice to express anger over the gun violence epidemic in the country. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, President Donald Trump met in Ohio on Wednesday with victims and first responders from one of last weekend's two deadly mass shootings. Crowds of protesters outside the hospital and in downtown Dayton held signs reading, "Hate not welcome here," and "Stop this terror." Later in the day, Trump visited the Texas city of El Paso on the border with Mexico. That's where 22 people were killed at a Walmart store on Saturday by a 21-year-old man who had posted an anti-immigrant manifesto online. At the Texas hospital, Trump touted the response to his visit.
We had an amazing day. As you know, we left Ohio, and the love, the respect for the office of the presidency, I wish you could have been in there to see it. I wish you could have been in there.
Well, the back-to-back massacres have reopened the national debate over gun safety. Nan Whaley, the mayor of Dayton, Ohio, said she spoke very frankly with the president.
We reiterated to the president the importance of action around these issues and guns, and that the people of Dayton are waiting for action from the Washington, D.C.
And Senator Sherrod Brown, the U.S. senator from Ohio, was also with the mayor and said he spoke to the president.
I asked the president to promise to me and to the American people that he will sign that bill after he's spoken out in support of it with Senator McConnell. He only said that we will get things done.
Former Vice President Joe Biden, the front runner in the race for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination, used some of his harshest language yet about Trump on Wednesday, saying he has fanned the flames of white supremacy.
Trump offers no moral leadership, seems to have no interest in unifying this nation, no evidence that the presidency has awakened his conscience in the least. Indeed, we have a president with a toxic tongue who has publicly and unapologetically embraced a political strategy of hate, racism, and division.
Trump has been accused by his Democratic critics and others of promoting white nationalism with his frequent attacks on immigrants and minorities. A 21-year-old white man killed 22 people in El Paso, Texas, over the weekend in a mass shooting he said was carried out to repel a, quote, Hispanic invasion. Biden laid some of the blame on Trump's doorstep. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, another 2020 Democratic hopeful, also denounced Trump Wednesday in a speech at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, where 9 black parishioners were shot dead in 2015 by a white supremacist. One of the two recent mass shootings in El Paso, as we said, is being treated as a case of domestic terrorism by U.S. federal authorities. The El Paso attack, which has left 22 people dead, has renewed the debate on how to combat domestic terrorism in the U.S. The FBI has expressed concerns that such attacks would inspire more homegrown extremists to carry out further violent attacks in the future. Joining us for that part of the story is Dr. Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. So this was something that the FBI director testified about to Congress recently, where he did warn that white nationalism is a major national security concern. So has anything been done yet since that warning?
In terms of governmental action, no, I don't think we have. Domestic terrorism is akin to any terrorism in that it requires a culture to survive. And what I mean by a culture is it requires people to encourage each other. And you see that, for example, you saw that with respect to ISIS, Boko Haram, or some of these other terrorist groups. They survive because there's a culture that allows them to survive. And what I find particularly frustrating about what's going on in this country with the mass shootings is that the culture, in some respects at least, is being encouraged by politicians. That is, when one demonizes others, whether it's African Americans, Hispanics, Muslims, any foreign group, that's encouraging people to say, oh, yeah, let's get together and do something about it. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's telling that every time there's one of these mass shootings, they research the guy who did it, mm-hmm. and invariably they find some sort of screed that he's written denouncing the other. And again, I don't care whether the others are homosexuals, Muslims, or whoever, but it requires that kind of culture. And unfortunately, we are in that kind of culture now in which we demonize others.
Would you say this would be equivalent to what we say about foreign terrorists that are radicalized?
Yeah, sure. There is a radicalization process. Absolutely. I mean, to ask yourself, what does it take to turn a normal, everyday American male into a mass killer? I mean, it's not like Mommy and Daddy said, hey, someday, son, you can take an AR-15 and kill 30 people. Nobody's raised that way. That kind of evil upbringing doesn't exist. So how does it arise? And that's what I'm suggesting. It arises in a culture that encourages that type of devious thought.
CNN has been reporting that the White House has repeatedly rejected the Department of Homeland Security's efforts to increase focus on domestic terrorism. They're citing current and former senior administration officials,
sure,
and sources close to the administration that said they just continued to push back on that effort to focus more on domestic terrorism. If Homeland Security was encouraging that, there must have been a reason. Why do you think that they would have not been interested?
Well, I think there's a concern that at least some of the people involved in that culture of us against them are natural supporters of the administration. Make America great.
Mm-hmm.
Make America great again. That sort of activity, telling those four congresswomen to go back to their country. That is the kind of thing that encourages that sort of culture of us against them. If they don't look like us, if they don't dress like us, they must be evil, so therefore it's okay to kill them.
What do you think the solution is here for our country going forward with rising domestic terrorist-type situations? I know they did open up an investigation and called it domestic terrorism because there was a hit list for the shooting we saw last month in Gilroy. But what do you think it takes? Is it a question of financing and funding?
I don't think that's the problem. Look, during the Kennedy-Johnson period, particularly the Johnson period, when that bevy of civil rights acts were created, there were two things going on. One was at the legal end, and the other was a president that said, we are one country, we are one people, we're going to treat everybody equally under the law. And it seems to me that a president can do that sort of thing by saying, look, this country was created under immigrants. My family were immigrants. And to reject immigrants and to reject other cultures, in effect, is to reject the American way of life.
All right. Dr. Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University, thanks for being with us. Meanwhile, Amnesty International has issued a travel warning calling for possible travelers and visitors to the United States to exercise extreme caution to rampant gun violence. Amnesty says it amounts to a human rights crisis and appears to mirror the model from the U.S. State Department's advice for U.S. travelers going to other countries. Joining us to talk more about this is Amnesty, or Ernest Coverson, campaign manager for the End Gun Violence Campaign at Amnesty International USA. What led your organization to issue this warning?
The gun violence crisis that's taken place in the U.S. and has been going on for some time now, and over the weekend, as you know, took front and center again. And so our comrades and colleagues from across the world reached out and wondered how could they also support and work with the AIUSA section in regards to bringing more attention to the issue of the gun violence within the U.S. confines. And so looking at other ways that like the State Department and others have dealt with situations in other countries, we decided and came up with the idea of doing a travel warning to let individuals know that coming to the U.S., there is a possibility of a shooting, you know, that may take place at a movie theater, at a church, at a park or festival, et cetera. That has taken place, as we've seen, has taken place over the years.
What exactly did the warning say?
The actual warning says, you know, if you decide to come to the United States, to be extra vigilant at all times and be worried of firearms amongst the population, you know, to avoid places where large numbers of people gather, especially cultural events, places of worship, schools, and shopping malls. Lastly, to exercise increased caution when visiting local bars, nightclubs, and casinos as well.
Has your organization been hearing a lot of concerns from people overseas? Are they watching intently with what is going on here?
Yes, I think, you know, many countries are watching. Many of the amnesty sections around the world are watching and want to support both, you know, the survivors, victims' families, et cetera, on the gun violence, that the senseless gun violence that has taken place here in the U.S. You know, as we as the U.S., is a, you know, a world power. You know, many folks look at USA to lead the world. And so with all of the things that have been happening around gun violence, around the racism, the immigration issue, et cetera, it is a high priority around the world. I mean, looking at how we are as the U.S. going to deal with this rampant gun violence.
Have we ever seen this kind of warning here in the United States?
AIUSA has not put out a travel warning before, and we're looking at the global movement and seeing if other sections have listed or put out travel warnings prior to. But this is the first time that we have, as Amnesty USA, had a travel warning for coming to the USA.
All right, that is Ernest Coverson. He is a campaign manager for the End Gun Violence Campaign at Amnesty International. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOANews.com. The Trump administration orders a freeze on congressionally approved foreign aid. Pakistan downgrades its ties with India as tensions rise over Kashmir. Turkey and the U.S. progress on a joint safe zone in northern Syria. And researchers in Uganda will start a 2-year Ebola vaccine trial. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at VOANews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. The world took anxious notice this week when Russian President Vladimir Putin threatened the possibility of a new nuclear arms race with the U.S. Putin was responding to President Trump's decision Friday to let America's 1987 Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia lapse. The State Department claims that Russia continues to violate the agreement. Russia denies the accusation and calls upon the U.S. to negotiate. To help explain the dispute over the INF and analyze the geopolitics involved, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Russia expert Thomas Graham, a distinguished fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York.
Putin has been talking about this for some time, since the United States raised the issue of withdrawing from the INF treaty back last fall. He's always talked about the INF treaty as one of the keystones of the global arms control regime, and that eliminating that treaty would open the way to an arms race. But if you look very carefully at the statement that he released after the U.S. withdrawal, it does again say that there's a possibility of an arms race because of the U.S. action. But he's very cautious in what he says Russia is prepared to do. He is making the point that it is not Russia that's going to initiate this arms race, that, you know, Russia is not going to develop or deploy INF range missiles unless the United States does. So it's going to follow the American lead and in a way throwing the onus in the United States court. Now, of course, in saying this, he overlooks the fact that as far as the United States is concerned, Russia has already violated that treaty. And that was one of the reasons that the United States gave for withdrawing from the treaty, that Russia has, in fact, over the past several years, developed and deployed a missile that fell within the range that was prohibited by the INF treaty.
Why do you think Putin said this? Do you think it's sort of he's posturing for his domestic constituency, or do you think that he's just sort of stirring the pot? I mean, he's not necessarily a friend of peaceful equilibrium with the United States in recent years.
Part of it is directed at a domestic audience, and that is that, you know, Russia is a great power. It sees itself, at least in the nuclear realm, as the equivalent of the United States. I think second, it's directed towards a European audience to raise concerns about what the United States is doing, to present the United States as reckless, in the hope that this will undermine the cohesion of the NATO alliance and also undermine the cohesion of the transatlantic community. Again, goals that Putin has been pursuing for some time.
Okay, so you're not overly concerned, but you're guarded.
No, I'm not overly concerned about the INF treaty. The bigger question really is the fate of the New START agreement, which expires in February 2021 if it's not extended by the United States and Russia. The administration, particularly John Bolton, has already indicated that he believes it's unlikely that that treaty will be extended. Now, that, I think, has more serious consequences because that is a treaty that regulated strategic nuclear arms, not non-ballistic missiles, and so forth, that I think is important to maintaining strategic stability between the United States and Russia. It also has a number of competence-building measures in its monitoring regime and verification regime that are politically important for the U.S.-Russian relationship at this point. If that treaty goes away, then I think the situation does change in a significant way. And it does leave the world without any large and far-reaching strategic arms limitation agreements. It undermines the arms control regime that has built up over the past 40 or 50 years. So the START agreement is the one that I would focus on as opposed to the INF treaty.
All right. That was Russia expert Thomas Graham with the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. Well, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which granted millions of American women the right to vote. The relentless struggle of suffragists who advocated for women's rights to vote is the focus of a new National Archives exhibit, as VOA's Elizabeth Chernoff tells us in this report.
The National Archives in Washington retains some of the most important pieces of American history, like the 19th Amendment, which the U.S. Congress passed nearly a century ago.
Almost 100 years ago, the 19th Amendment became law, prohibiting states and the federal government from denying the right to vote to American citizens on the basis of sex. And here at the National Archives, we're really proud to commemorate this important anniversary.
From pioneer suffragists like civil rights activist Ida B. Wells Barnett to the countless women who made a difference in their diaspora communities, the Rightfully Hers exhibit shows visitors what it took for women across America to be able to vote. Even before securing that right, women were active participants in American democracy. Like Jeanette Rankin of Montana, who won a congressional seat in 1916 before the 19th Amendment passed, and she wasn't alone. Many women served their country during World War I working for the Red Cross. And the tradition of women supporting political causes and candidates endures to this day. While highlighting landmark victories of the past, Rightfully Hers also focuses on the challenges still facing voters today.
It reminds us that the right to vote, which is so basic to our understanding of democracy, is not always guaranteed, but was won through the work of generations of tireless activists.
Curator Corrine Porter says she hopes the message of the exhibit resonates with women globally.
Your power to vote is also your voice in government, and so I think that's true around the world, and so certainly I hope that for the women of the world, they see that and vote if they can and continue to press for their voting rights if they can.
From the past to the present, women participating in democracy continues to be a time-honored American tradition. Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News, Washington.
And you are listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Medical experts in Kenya are banking on human breast milk to save the lives of newborn babies. Nairobi's Pumwani Maternity Hospital has set up East Africa's first breast milk bank, the second in Africa, to provide donated milk to babies in need. As Sarah Kimani reports from Nairobi, the milk bank appears to be having an impact.
We arrived at Pumwani Maternity Hospital just in time for feeding. Anne Auma holds onto a bottle with one hand as the other supports her baby who was born 1 month early. Auma has been sick, so she cannot breastfeed as recommended by the World Health Organization. She would have been forced to use less healthy formula milk. In March, Nairobi's Pumwani Maternity Hospital open the region's first human milk bank. Auma says the milk bank has helped her because when she became ill, making her unable to nurse the child, the baby was given milk from the bank. Kenya's Ministry of Health and PATH, a US-based non-profit health organization, launched the milk bank plan in March with the hope of reducing the number of newborn deaths, which are currently at 39 per 1,000 live births. The milk bank is for premature babies, those born with low birth weight, and those whose mothers may not be able to breastfeed them. While only 58 babies have benefited from the milk bank so far, hospital staff say more mothers are living with healthy newborns. Kezia Njao is the head nurse at the hospital.
Though the project is still very young, we have already noted that the neonatal mortality rate is going down drastically.
The breast milk bank is the first in East Africa and the second opened on the continent after South Africa. The World Health Organization says premature babies have a higher chance of survival if fed breast milk instead of formula. Dr. Elizabeth Kimani Murage, the senior research scientist at Nairobi's African Population and Health Research Center, led the push for Nairobi's milk bank.
Research where human milk banking has been implemented has shown that neonates who are fed on like preterm babies and low birth weight children, when they are given donor human milk instead of formula, survive better.
Donors are sourced among mothers within the hospital. Mary Ndinda, one of the donors, says she's happy to save lives. She says she opted to donate to women who do not have milk or to babies who do not have mothers because her breasts were engorged and very painful just days after she gave birth. Kenyan authorities plan to set up other milk banks across the country if the one in Nairobi proves a success. Sarah Kimani for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Science in a Minute.
Volcanoes can go from periods of inactivity to becoming restless before they actually erupt. A new study led by researchers at the Carnegie Institution of Science and the Pennsylvania State University suggests some volcanoes on the cusp of eruption can be persistently restless for decades. The researchers found that volcanoes could go through three states of unrest. Signs of their first state of unrest can include a steady release of gas and changes in seismic activity. The second state may include a series of weak explosions. However, signs of the third state of unrest could include the deformation of surrounding landscape and large explosions that include the expulsion of rock fragments. The researchers say their findings could lead to forecasting models for persistently restless volcanoes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Took a trip to San Francisco.
American singer, songwriter, director, and poet Lana Del Rey has spoken out in song to the latest mass shootings in America. Just hours after she wrote her new song, Looking for America, Del Rey posted a video of the track on Instagram. The song, soft and emotional, is a musical conversation of her search for her version of America, which she says has no guns or bombs. She's not the only musician who has been speaking out about America's gun violence. Singer Rihanna tweeted, "Imagine a world where it's easier to get an AK-47 than a visa." And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for listening and joining us today. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
That's another space and time. We used to go to drive-ins and listen to the blues. So many things that I think twice about before I do. I'm still looking for my own version of America. One without the gun, where the flag can freely fly. No bombs in the sky, only fireworks when you and I collide. It's just a dream I had in my heart. It's just a dream I had in my heart. It's just a dream I had in my heart.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to promoting and protecting religious freedom around the world. That is why the United States Congress passed the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998. The bill aimed to strengthen the promotion of religious freedom as part of U.S. foreign policy. The law also established the bipartisan Commission on International Religious Freedom. The commission is independent from other government agencies, said current chairman Tony Perkins.
This was to create an independent watchdog organization that was separate from the administration, a creation of Congress that could report with unflinching focus on religious freedom, undistracted by other issues, whether they be policy issues, diplomatic issues. We're focused on one issue and one issue only.
The commission's 9 members are appointed by the president and by the leadership of the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. They hail from different political parties and different religious backgrounds, but are unified by their mission.
We work to track abuse of religious freedom, persecution, raise awareness of the issue, but also we make recommendations to the President, to the Secretary of State, and to the Congress on how to address these issues of religious persecution so that people everywhere can have the benefit of practicing what the 1948 Universal Declaration of Rights says is a fundamental human right, and that is the freedom of religion.
These recommendations are provided throughout the year as the Commission interacts with Congress and the executive branch of the U.S. government. They are also promoted through op-eds, press releases and articles, and summarized in an annual report. The Commission meets with senior government officials, representatives of non-governmental organizations, religious leaders, victims of persecution, and other stakeholders from around the world. The Commission's Religious Prisoners of Conscience Project calls for the release of individuals who have been imprisoned for their beliefs by oppressive regimes. Chairman Perkins noted that countries that protect religious freedom enjoy greater economic and social stability. "We can move the needle on this issue," said Chairman Perkins.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the